This is Dr. Hillary McClafferty. Welcome to Physician Thriving, a podcast exploring the modern physician experience with a focus on resilience and the skills needed to thrive in medicine. Good morning. I am here with Dr. Cora Bruner, and welcome, Cora. How are you this morning?
I'm fantastic. Thanks so much for inviting me.
It is my pleasure. Can you tell us a little bit about your current work and your position at Seattle Children's Hospital?
Sure. I am a professor of adolescent medicine and pediatrics at Seattle Children's Hospital and at the University of Washington. And I have been there for about 20 years now, actually. I had a very sort of circuitous and fun trajectory to getting to where I am right now. But we'll get into that later. But I think what I'd love to chat with about first is what I'm doing right now, which is in total juxtaposition of what I was doing 2 months ago. So what I do now is a lot of visits by phone when I used to do visits in person. And I do a lot of meetings about how to do care during this pandemic. And what I find fascinating about that is that when I first started thinking about being a doctor, I had no idea that this is what I'd be doing now.
Right. And you're based in Washington State, which was really one of the earliest, if not the earliest, epicenter really in the United States. Can you talk more about that and how that impacted your area and your colleagues and your children's hospital?
Yeah. It's really interesting. It was leap year day. So it was February 29th, 2020. And I actually was in Oakland moving my daughter from one house to another. And I'd heard about the first death in Washington State. And I remember we were just unpacking the U-Haul truck and hearing about it. And I looked at my daughter, Maggie, and I said, this is not okay. I'm going back. Obviously, I was going back the next day to Seattle. And she was surprised I was so gravely impacted by something like this. But we'd already been following what's been going on in Wuhan, China. And I already knew also that we had one person that had tested positive, but we hadn't had a death yet. And so I had this foreboding sense that our state was going to be the first state and that it was going to probably sweep through the United States quickly thereafter. So that was, I don't know, that was just this crazy thought in my mind as a physician. And I knew that the virus, from reading about it in China, that was predominantly impacting the elderly or the immunosuppressed or vulnerable elderly population. And that, to be honest with you, I knew also that it wasn't really going to be impacting or hadn't impacted the pediatric population, which is where I work. But I also take care of teenagers and young adults. That's predominantly what I do. And I had still not heard a whole lot of information about that population from the Chinese pandemic.
You know, part of the challenge of this, I think, for pediatricians has been the uncertainty with the way it manifests in kids. And also, as you say, I mean, there are so many vulnerable children. I mean, there are many, many children living with complex chronic illnesses who are more susceptible, I think, by definition to something like this. And at your hospital, I mean, you see a lot of that population, do you
not? Right. It's a tertiary care hospital, and Children's Hospital in Seattle covers 5 different states. So Alaska, Montana, Wyoming, Washington, and Idaho all funnel their patients to us. So we have a huge geographic catchment of people, including a very large Native American population, Hispanic population, African American population, Chinese, Asians. We have a lot of people we take care of with a lot of different, very complicated, complex medical issues, and their families, of course, because they all come together.
How has this impacted your colleagues, basically? Like, what's your sense of what's happening with the physician group at your hospital and in your circles?
Well, that's such a great question, Hillary, because I think I've noticed, and it's based on noticing a lot of things over my life, which I'm sure we'll get into what I've been through to get to be right here. But what I've noticed is my colleagues, the ones who are alone, who don't have families, have a different perspective on this than those who do. So those who have families who are home with them, if they're not in the hospital, are worried about their children because, of course, they're not going to school, but they also have their children. So they have the worries of providing homeschooling for them and keeping them safe, but they also can have fun with them, and they can also go outside and walk their pets. So those people I'm not as concerned about. I'm more concerned about those who are living alone for whatever reason and have children are out of the house, or they don't have children or partners. And so they're very isolated, I think. And so I am a very gregarious, extroverted person. So I've been running virtual happy hours for my colleagues, my women support groups, pretty much, and my family, extended family, every night of the week. And honestly, a couple of the other groups that children's were saying at a leadership meeting, apparently I heard it from my boss, they thought maybe they should consider having happy hours in their divisions. And my boss said, well, we've been doing it already for a month because Quora has started this. And initially it was just for the providers. And then I opened it up to the entire adolescent medicine division. And there's 92 of us extended throughout the whole five-state region. And so it's been pretty helpful. And I hope, I've obviously studied it, but I really feel the connection with each other is so important right now, because we're all, you know, behaving, right? So we're all staying home unless we need to come into the hospital. And so that is, that's hard, especially for the people that are really, really used to hallway conversations or break room, having a meal together with someone they work with, and not having that, I think is really isolating and can be really damaging.
Tell me, I totally agree with you. Tell me more about when you first set up the virtual happy hour. What did people, like, what was their initial reaction?
Oh, that's a great question. So people, those who are pretty used to having agendas and having bullet points and action items, didn't come or didn't know what it was about. And I'm an idea person. So I'm the kind of person that comes up with ideas. So I always need a person with me that does the massive follow through. And I know that about myself. I've known that for years. So I have somebody with me that's the timekeeper and comes up with like an agenda item. So last week we said to the group, my daughter, Maggie, I'll give her total credit for this, came up with this, which is, for our happy hours, we have a theme. So this last one was a rose, a bud, and a thorn. So you were supposed to say, what about the day was a rose, and what was a bud? So like a budding rose, and what was a thorn? And about that day. And so everybody shared what was the rose, which could have been that it was, we've had such great weather here over the past couple of weeks, which has been such a blessing. And what's a bud, like what you're looking forward to? And pretty much everybody said this to be over.
right.
And having a big Evite party in like September. And also the thorn, which is interesting because that was very different for a lot of people, which was like, can't go to the grocery store enough, or can't come into work, or school's out, or lots of thorns, but kind of bookending it with a bud and a rose was really, really, really nice. And again, that was not my idea, but everybody did it. And it was just really fun to hear everybody's thoughts.
That's awesome. And then, so you started out with how many people on the first couple of sessions?
About 4 to 5 and maybe 8 the third. And then this last one, we had about 25. So I have a Zoom account. So shout out to Zoom for this, even though I know that it'd be nice if we could literally meet in person. They do a pretty good job of allowing the platform be such that you can see everybody if they want you to see them. So that's kind of nice too. So you can see the person.
That is awesome. You know, tell us a little bit about how you found your way to medicine in the first place. Like, how did you decide and when did you decide to pursue that path?
That was so interesting. No one in my family was in medicine at all. My father was in advertising for a company in Delaware, which is where I'm from, the DuPont Company. And my mom was a stay-at-home mom. And my siblings were not interested really in medicine. My aunts and uncles were not either. My grandfather was an artist, and my grandmother also was an artist. By the way, I can't do anything. I'm totally craft deprived. but my sister is an artist, and my other sister is eventually became a therapist. But it's really interesting. So I came through without a lot of forethought in terms of wanting to be one. What was interesting though is when my mom did start going back to work when I was in high school, she worked at a nursing home at an assisted living facility and was the social director. So I think that's where I got my social buzz is from my mother. And sitting up in heaven smiling right now. But anyway, so I went over to the nursing home with her a couple afternoons a week to work with some of the people that were there because their families weren't there and they wanted to hire somebody that could be with their grandmother or their mom and spend a couple hours with them.
Yeah.
So I would just hang out in the nursing homes with these people and hear their stories. And so, excuse me, I'm going to sip of coffee. So my first blush with any of that was working with the elderly, which is so ironic because I'm a pediatrician, but I love working with them. I love listening to their stories and seeing them perk up when I got there. They were so happy to see me. And that was my first time that I thought, maybe there is something to getting someone to feel better. And maybe this is what I want to do. I also spent some time with kids with cerebral palsy. I had an elective in high school where I was doing aqua therapy with kids with cerebral palsy. So again, just something I thought, this might be fun. So those are the things that I started with. And then this is kind of an interesting complete digression, but I was thought, okay, I'll be pre-med then. So I was pre-med in college and then I took organic chemistry. Bummer. So yeah, that was not cool. So I had my first midterm and I got a B-. And I thought, no way, I can't be a doctor because I have to get an A in O-Chem. So I remember I called my dad. It was a Saturday morning when I had gotten my grade Friday afternoon. And I said, Dad, I'm not going to be a doctor. I got a B- in O-Chem. I can't do it. So this was in college in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is right outside Philadelphia at Franklin and Marshall. So then my dad got in the car. It's about 2 hours from Wilmington, Delaware, which is where I'm from. And he drove to Lancaster, literally just got in the car and drove to me. And got there about 10 in the morning. And of course, this is pre-cell phone, pre-everything, right? So I had no idea that he was coming. Anything.
Oh, wow.
He just boom, showed up at my dorm and said, let's go. We're going to take a drive. And so we drove to this beautiful wildlife refuge near the campus and just sat and watched the geese and the birds, herons, ducks. We just sat there and watched these animals in the fall. Birds fly around and just walked around for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours just talking. Or he was talking and I was listening. And he just said to me, Cora, he called me Coco, it doesn't matter. If you don't want to do it, you don't need to. It's not, life isn't worth it. If you don't want to pursue this career, it's because he knew how hard I was working and how miserable I was. About this. And he said, it doesn't matter. I love you no matter what, it's fine. So that was, I was like 20, I guess. And which was a while ago. And I remember thinking, wow, that was this unconditional love that I experienced from my dad that held me through. So then he drove back. He just literally dropped me back off at my dorm and drove back home to Delaware, and then Monday I started afresh, and then I aced it. I didn't try so hard anymore. I just did what I could do, and I just didn't push myself to the point of exhaustion. And I did mm-hmm. fine. And here I am. So that was my first blush with all that. So then, so wound up going to medical school in Philadelphia. And, but the other thing that happened actually was that my dad, when I got accepted into medical school in at Jefferson, he was really sick and tired of being in an advertising world. And he was by that time working in New York City, and my mom and dad had gotten divorced, and it was pretty yucky, that part. And so he just really wanted to become a farmer. And we had a family farm in Ohio that we'd had in the family since 1726, really old wow. farm. And so he visited there a lot, but never actually lived there. And so he said, Coco, I really want to be a farmer. But if you need me to stay in the advertising world to pay for medical school, I will. And he'd already put my older sister through Harvard and my other sister through Pratt, which is the art school in Brooklyn. So I thought, that's not cool. And I'm and me through Franklin Marshall. So that's when I decided to join the military. So I thought of the three arms of the service, because I knew there was this way you could go to medical school free-ish. So
yeah,
I thought,
yeah, exactly.
Army, no. Air Force, Navy, water, yes, I could do that. So I went to this like recruiting office in downtown Manhattan with my acceptance letter to medical school, and I said, okay, I'm ready to sign up right now, let's do it. And they're like, whoa, you can't just do that. You have to, it's the same process. You have to apply. You have to get your governor and your senator to write you letters. And there's a whole nother application process because a lot of people are trying to do this. I went, what? So I had to go through the whole application process again, got in to the Navy program. So I finished medical school. Dad became a farmer. And I did my residency in pediatrics in San Diego at the Navy Hospital in Balboa. Oh. So I plunked away from the East Coast and became a West Coast gal. Many people had always thought I was a West Coast gal because of just the way I am. But I'm not. I'm actually from the East Coast completely. And my family's still there, et cetera. So I was in San Diego, did my pediatric residency. I was a ship doctor for a year, finished my, and had to spend some time paying back the military. So I spent 2 years in Japan as a pediatrician and then got out of the Navy in the Northwest. And that was up here in Seattle.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of, and then there's more, right? Because then I did adolescent med. I mean, there's just, it goes on and on.
Yeah. Tell me about the adolescent piece. I mean, how did that all come together for you in terms of specializing?
Yeah. So I, you know, and you're going to laugh when you hear this. I thought, because I super loved all the intensiveness of neonatology. So I thought, I'm going to be a neonatologist. Which, for those who know me, they think, what? But yeah, I really, really wanted to be a neonatologist, super wanted to be a neonatologist. Because during my residency, I had this incredible neonatologist, Dr. Harriman, who was just amazing physician and healer and just kind and brilliant and just a role model for me. So I wanted to be him. I wanted to do that. But then I went to do my payback in Japan. And I also really like teenagers. So this is kind of an interesting juxtaposition of working with teenagers. I think because my teenage years were kind of tumultuous. And so mm-hmm. I thought, why don't I see if I want to do adolescent medicine? Let me just see if I can, I'll just open an adolescent medicine clinic, a teen health clinic at the high school here and on the Navy base. So, and that's called the DODS, which is Department of Defense School. High school on the military base in Yokosuka, Japan. So I went there every Wednesday afternoon where there was a nurse that she was really gung-ho. Because again, I thought, what a great idea. No one had ever done teen health centers before in the country at all. This is pre all that. So wow. I just went over, took my uniform off and put on like jeans and a t-shirt, went over there. Nobody came to see me. And I was like, what? I thought I was like super cool and everybody would want to see me. Right, so then I like, called my other mentor in San Diego, Dr. John Sella. And I said, hey, John, I'm trying to start a teen health center here. And he goes, oh, great idea. Well, how's it going? I'm like, terribly. No one's coming. And he said, well, what are you wearing? And I said, what? What do you mean, what am I wearing? And he goes, what are you wearing to the teen health center? I said, jeans and a t-shirt. And he goes, no. You got to keep your uniform on because we obviously were in uniforms as we were in the military, a Navy uniform. And so I thought, what? Why would they want me to be in uniform? And he said, well, because that's their parents' employer. They're used to it. That is, it's not the man and something, you know, bad. It's actually completely normal. And you have a lot of credibility because you are an officer in the military. So I thought, okay. So I just cut my uniform on and just went over to the high school every Wednesday afternoon. And within 2 weeks, I was completely packed with people, with kids. It was just... So that was when I realized, well, I want to do adolescent medicine and I need to do a fellowship as soon as I can because I don't know what the heck I'm doing.
Where did you do your adolescent fellowship?
Well, that was interesting too. So I finished my obligation in to the Navy in Whidbey Island. And so it was just north of Seattle. I always try to make sure this is what I want to do. So I drove down to Seattle Children's Hospital once a week on my half a day off. I had half a day off a week to do charts and stuff. So instead of doing that, I did that in the evenings and I drove down to Children's and spent a half day a week with Dr. Mark Smith, another mentor, who let me just shadow him. And so I did that for a year, actually, thinking I really want, and that's when I realized I want to do a fellowship. So mm-hmm. I got out of the military and got married and actually spent a year. This is another digression, but I also wanted to do one more thing that was holistic and globally minded because I loved working in Japan. So my husband and I worked in Pakistan. So we spent a year working with Afghan refugees in this place called Peshawar, which is up near Kabul, Afghanistan. And so we both took care of Afghan refugees for a year with a group out of Los Angeles called International Medical Corps, which was super, super cool. And I learned a lot of medicine that I had never learned before, which was how to do it without many supplies. And I worked side by side with Afghan doctors and other doctors from all over the country who were volunteering there to take care of 2 million people who were refugees in Pakistan. So after I came back to Seattle, and that's where I've been ever since. So I did a fellowship in adolescent medicine, got my master's of public health, and started working with predominantly with teenagers, whether it's on a football field or with homeless kids or in the jails. That's pretty much all that I've been doing since I did my fellowship.
That is amazing. Now, I am sure, I know for a fact that you have seen some incredibly tough cases, you know, patients, humans, young people, and help them through some very challenging circumstances. Tell me how you take care of yourself helping others get through those challenges.
Wow. That's a big question. Big question, Hillary. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know.
Well,
let's break it down. How did you learn to do it? Like, you know, what did you try that didn't work? And then how did you learn sort of feel your way towards what does work? Cause it's a process.
Right. Which is kind of like riding a bike. And once you figure it out, you got it, but you do need to keep practicing it. So from the very start, I realized that I needed to be physically active. So right from when I was even in high school, I was always had a sport that I did. So they didn't have soccer really when I was growing up for girls. So I played field hockey and lacrosse. And I tried to play basketball, but I was terrible. My kid's like, Mom, don't, what, why? I'm like, I know. I do lots of sports, but I'm real. Anyway, so I, not only did I feel that I needed to be physically active, but I also needed to be on a team. So I, to get that for me personally. And that started really, really young. And I also recognized that I needed just to turn things off as well. And I needed to make sure I got enough sleep. So for my colleagues who don't get, or my family members that don't get enough sleep, I just feel for them because I know that for me, that's just interestingly never, ever been a problem for me to fall asleep. I'm one of those boop out, like a Duracell bunny or something. I just completely just do shut down when I go to bed. So getting enough sleep, getting enough exercise, and getting proper nutrition were always, and the nutrition piece was always coming in from mom. Mom was always just very much wanted to make sure that we had breakfast and lunch and dinner, and we had, we didn't have a lot of money. So we always did a lot of packed lunches, which I find fun. Cause I think that's just for me always been interesting that I love to make lunch ahead of time and have it ready for me. So those are the three obvious things. I know I talk about that a lot when I'm teaching about self-care, but they seem to go by the wayside, especially for doctors, because we're supposed to be superhuman and we're not supposed to sleep and we're supposed to eat in front of the computer and we're supposed to be on call, quote unquote, 24/7, and which is, as you can think about it, is an impossible goal. It just doesn't work. And then something, you know, snaps and breaks. And we know this from seeing our peers who burn out and get despondent or even take their own life. It's just, it's hard to see that happen.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's always easier to see it in somebody else than to recognize it in ourselves, you know. How have you sort of cultivated that sense of self-awareness? Like, do you recognize when you're, sort of getting near the slippery slope of, I need to make some course corrections? Like, how do you pay attention to that?
Yes. You know, and it's so interesting, that question juxtaposed on what's going on right now with everybody being homebound. I know for myself that I need contact with other humans. I really do. And with all of this isolation, there's a really interesting metaphor that I've been teaching the residents and fellows and even my colleagues at work about, which is when you get isolated, there's times when you dig yourself into a hole. And so to get out of that hole, not only do you have to get out of the hole, but you have to climb over the big bunch of dirt you made. So it's like double, right? You dug yourself into a hole and then you have to get over that big mound of dirt that you dug out of the hole to get back to where you're supposed to be. So I have some things I recognize in myself, which is that I might start snapping at my partner or my son's living with me right now. So I might start saying something that I never would have said. And I have a rule, a super hard and fast rule, that I don't send any emails after 9 p.m. If I do, I send them to myself and I check them in the morning, and 95% of the time I realize, wow, that's super not cool saying it that way. So delete it or change it. So I have noticed in myself that I might want to break that rule and send one after then. Or even more alarming is actually sending one that is a little more harsh than I would have thought I would have sent. And so I'm just noticing that my communication with others doesn't have the filters that I usually have. So that's been, at least for me, a huge big red flag that I need to do better self-care because I'm not using all of my skills.
Right. Are there other things that you use or have learned along the way, or tried and had, you know, what I like to call a spectacular failure, which is such an important learning experience that you'd like to share with your colleagues?
A lot of those. Yeah. One of the very cool things about being a third kid in a pretty competitive family is that I don't always have to be right. I can be the first one to say that was not right at all. So when I had cancer 2 years ago, everybody told me that I needed to learn how to knit. And so I thought, okay, right. It's funny.
I'm sorry. Cora, I have knitting, to laugh. I know. Just a minute. Okay.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. So, and my sister Amy, who is dear friend, who passed away a number of years ago, also from cancer, but she was an incredible artist, right? And she also was an amazing knitter. So this one is going to get her laughing up in heaven as well. So I super started learning how to knit, right? So I went to the knitting class for cancer patients and I was like there every single week. And it looks like crocheting when I knit. So because I keep dropping stitches. So always I can't figure out how to pull them back up. So someone said, well, just sew it back together again. Like what? Oh, what? So I've made like 5 scarves and they look so ridiculous. So that's a colossal failure is me knitting. And for all my knitting friends out there who are listening, I know you've all come over to my house and helped me and felt, and some of you have actually done the whole thing again. But then when I pick it up again, I start dropping. Ridiculous.
Oh, you're
but
anyway, stressing so your knitting yeah. mentors.
Yes. My mentors are like, come on. So that's that. But anyway, but it is really, really helpful. I still have every time I sit in front of the TV, I either journal or knit, even though, and everybody laughs because it looks so terrible, but I don't care. It just makes me feel better. Yeah. I'm not really making anything. I'm just doing something with my hands. The thing that has been a success is playing the fiddle. So when I was a kid, my mom and dad really insisted on all of us learning to play some instrument. And so for me, it was the violin. So I was one of those Suzuki kids. And so I took the Suzuki class every week and I was in orchestra and I had violin lessons until I was 13. And I came home one day because my violin teacher was pretty critical and had super bad breath. And so I'm in this tiny room with her. And so I was like, I came home to my mom and said, I don't want to take violin anymore. She has really bad breath and she's really mean and I hate it. And she said, fine, I'll save the money from it. We could use that for something else. Done. So I kept my violin, but I stopped playing it, obviously. And I just kept it and kept it and kept it. It was my Uncle Orville's. So it's this really old, beautiful violin until, about 8 years ago, I took my kids to Ireland because I've always wanted to go. And we toured around and went to a number of different towns and went to a number of pubs to have dinner. And they have these fiddle sessions, which is fiddles and guitar and mandolin, and flute and Irish dancing. And it's just this incredible thing happened to me. I thought, oh my gosh, I want to play a fiddle. It just like resonated with me. Like it was like something went ring like inside of me. And so I came home and my son, McKay, who's, knows me better than anybody, I think. Well, all my kids do. Gave me a fiddle lesson from this one person in town that was taking adult students, but she was reticent to take another one. So he said, "Well, Mom, just have one lesson with my mom. Once you meet my mom, you'll get hooked on her." And so, so he put like $50 in this envelope under the Christmas tree and said, "You got a lesson with Kathy Whitesides." So I had a lesson the next week with her. I'd pulled my violin, which is the same as a violin, by the way. It's the same instrument. It's just called a fiddle, but it's exactly the same. And so I had a lesson with her and bam, I've been having lessons with her every week for 8 years. We play in pubs and, I'm not super good, but I'm
that's
gung-ho
awesome.
About it and I'm motivated and I'm a good sport, I guess is what she calls me sometimes. But shout out to Kathy. But anyway, so that's been the thing that I've actually, the success that I've had in terms of self-care.
Yeah, that's tremendous. Thank you for sharing that for sure. And, you know, when you work with residents or if you're thinking about your colleagues around the country right now, do you have any sort of last thoughts or things that you'd like to share with them as we move forward collectively as a profession?
Yeah, I think I heard a really great meditation yesterday, and during this time we're doing a lot of meditations with each other, and I just want to share it because I've been sharing something like this with the residents, medical students, and fellows that I've been working with, because this is a really, really, really challenging time for them, because a lot of them, they're not in the hospitals as much as we are because they're students. So we really want them to stay as healthy, obviously, as they can. But but they're not getting some of the education that, well, a lot of the education that they would have gotten because they're not at the hospital. So they're doing a lot of online learning, and I'm doing a lot of online teaching of them.
Yeah. Yeah,
without actually seeing a patient. I'm just talking about patients with them. But one of the things I've been doing with them is reflecting on, especially because we're in the Northwest and we're surrounded by mountains and water, and we have really crystal clear air right now because it's not as polluted because there's not as many planes and cars flying around. I feel that the meditation I've been working on with them is called Mountain, Water, and Sky. And it's about the first piece is being the mountain, which is sitting tall and stable and comfortable and pointing towards the sky and being resolute and calm and not moving, just being a strong, solid mountain and pulling that piece of solidarity in your body and recognizing that we can be resolute, we can be tall, and we can be beautiful and serene. And then what I talk about with the water, and especially the waves on the water, that's like the breath. So when you're breathing in and out, you're just like the waves in the water or the wind over the water. It's very serene also. And it's also just going to keep happening. And the waves are just going to keep happening. The breath is going to keep happening. Just need to concentrate and focus on it and stay comfortable realizing that the breath comes and then the next breath comes and the next breath comes, just like the waves on water. And then I talk about the sky, which is our ability to just be, which is our mind and clear. There are times when there's rain and there's times when there's snow or hail, but it's the sky which peeks out through the clouds, blue and clear, and with thoughts that are focused and basically dreams about what's going to happen, and staying firm in the resolution that with the mountain and the water and the sky, our body, our breath, and our mind, we're going to be okay.
Cora, thank you so much for sharing that. That is so powerful, and I'm sure that is going to help many, many people. On that note, I would like to thank you so much for sharing your time, and I wish you well, and we'll talk soon.
Thanks, Hillary. It's been really, really wonderful being on the show. It just makes me feel so good just talking to you.
Thank you, Cora. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks.